And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I am recording this podcast on November 6th, Election Day, and I am reminded, as we have this contest that appears to be very close between the two parties, I'm reminded of the impact that an election can have on investors. In fact, an election can turn a buy and holder, I should say the outcome of an election, could turn a buy and holder into a market timer. And when I was an advisor, I tried to stay as neutral as possible as I could on any political topic, because I never thought there was going to be an improvement in the way an investor acted if I got into a heavy-duty discussion about politics and what I happen to personally believe. Because if I say that I'm conservative and the person I'm speaking with is liberal, not only am I probably not going to change their thinking, nor are they going to change mine, but it potentially creates a wall and colors everything I say about what I think is in their best interest as an investor. After all, if Paul is a conservative, I already know he doesn't think straight. That might be the response of the liberal. On the other hand, if I say that I'm a liberal, I've got the same problem with a conservative. I never wanted to create that wall, and I'll never forget a 45-minute conversation. Maybe it was an hour, maybe it was 30 minutes, but it was a fellow in Louisville when Clinton was elected. And John called me, and he said, "Sell everything." And I said, what do you mean, sell everything?" He said, "I am not going to have a dollar in the stock market as with Bill Clinton as the president. I don't trust him. I think the world's going to hell." I mean, it's, you know, the way that people who feel strongly about a candidate can think at a time of let's call it major change. It certainly was a change for him. And so I go into my spiel about how historically it doesn't matter who the president is, that you can have bull markets with Republicans, you can have bull markets with Democrats. The long-term performance shows that if you inflation adjust their returns, they're very similar. But it turned out favorably for John. By the way, didn't have to turn out favorably, that John stayed the course, because I can't know what the future is going to bring. No advisor can know that. And so while we may fight for our belief, let's say, in a buy and hold strategy, and that you're better off to have, you know, have the right amount of fixed income and stay the course and all of that, you can't know. Your advice in hindsight could be terrible if, in fact, the market falls precipitously. So what happened was, it turned out that over that 8 years, that while Clinton was the president, and it, from my viewpoint, it doesn't matter who was the president, to the extent that the market itself had an amazing 8-year run. And didn't we see the same thing with Trump? A lot of people thought that when Trump was elected, that was the end of the world. So my view is that anything that causes us to forget all the hard work and thinking and figuring out who we are, what rate of return we need, how much risk we're willing to take, what we don't want to become, if we believe in buy and hold, we don't want to become a market timer, because all of the evidence anecdotally that I know leads me to believe that that kind of market timing is not helpful in the long term. And we've talked before about the Dalbar study, and Morningstar has done similar studies. In fact, you can go to Morningstar. You can see what the average investor gets versus the mutual fund itself. And what we know is that at least it appears that the average return for the investor is way lower than the return of the mutual fund. And that's because of the things we do, and typically those are emotional things that we do. So John has passed away, and his wife, Judy, amazing, amazing people. And sometimes when you're an advisor, you earn your keep not by telling people what's going to happen, but by just simply controlling those emotions. And that's the weakness for the do-it-yourself investor. Some people are good at staying the course. Other people, not so good. Well, I've got a number of questions I want to address today. I specifically am going to stay away from questions regarding the two funds for life strategy, because we'll be having a separate podcast in the next couple of weeks on that topic. And I'm buried with questions I haven't responded to, so I want to apologize for not being able to take more questions recently. We spent a lot of time getting ready for the AAII presentation in Las Vegas and introducing the new two funds for life strategy. That's going well, by the way. I know that there are people out there who are telling others about this. We can see it in the number of opens that we're having in the article and in the video that we did. Keep up the good work. Okay, enough about that. Let me respond to some questions. And there probably are a couple dozen very common questions, but they always come somehow presented in a way that that requires a slightly different kind of an answer. But this comes from one of our readers who says, I want to keep around 45 to 50% of my IRA in bonds. I'm 63 and retired. My wife still works, and I do get two pensions, so not taking any distributions now, nor I will for the next 4 to 5 years. Not taking Social Security now, and won't until after my full retirement age, assuming my wife continues to work. Now, this is the kind of information that I get in most of the emails. You know something, even though it doesn't impact my answer because I can't act like a personal investment advisor, it does give me a kind of a sense of what's on people's minds and where they are. Because his question is this. He says, my question is, why are most bond index funds returning a negative amount right now? In other words, why are they losing money? Why am I down for the year? He goes on to say, I understand the interest rate versus bond price dynamic, but since bonds provide a dividend, why the negative return? Now, I'm going to save his last question until I go over this first part. I'm not sure that he totally understands this relationship between the bond price and the direction of interest rates. I assume what he says is that when interest rates go up, bond prices go down. And that is basically because the bond prices need to reflect the current interest rate. For example, if you had a bond that you purchased when interest rates were 10%, so you bought it for $1,000 and you're getting $100 a year, and interest rates go down to 5%, well, the value of that bond has theoretically just gone up to about $2,000 because 5%, or that $100 would be 5% of $2,000. So you're going to find as interest rates decline, bonds go up. As interest rates go up, bonds go down. And what we also know is that because short-term bonds are often being maturing and you're purchasing new short-term bonds inside of a mutual fund, that as those bonds mature, they get back to the par value of the bonds, which means that short-term bonds are not going to fluctuate very much with interest rates rising and falling, because you're just maybe a few months away from those bonds maturing, as opposed to a bond that's maturing in a decade. There you can have a lot of volatility. You would expect when interest rates are going up to suffer bigger declines in the principal value of the bond. But when I look at year-to-date returns on Morningstar of bond funds, that return is the outcome of the interest, what they call a dividend in the case of a bond fund, the interest or dividend being paid, reinvested, as well as the impact on the principal value as interest rates go up or down. And so what we've had is this period of rising interest rates, and I could look, for example, at an intermediate term investment grade bond fund. It's one that we have in our monthly income portfolio at Vanguard. And this one is for the investor share class. There, you'd get a little bit higher return if you were in the Admiral shares. But I'm being lazy. I looked up the one that was quick to look up. And what do I see? I see that that particular bond fund right now has a 30-day SEC yield of 3.7%. Well, intermediate-term bonds are going to have more volatility than, for example, a short-term bond, and we'll look at that in just a second. But for the year through November 5th, that bond is down, total return-wise, 2.37% versus the income it's paying is more than that, but the bond principal value has declined more than the interest rate that it has received. Now let's look at a short-term investment-grade bond fund. Now, by the way, the SEC yield there is 3.3%, so you're getting a higher rate of return with the riskier bond. That generally is the way it works. But that short-term investment-grade bond fund is actually up for the year. In other words, it is not responding with as much volatility as that longer-term bond fund did, the intermediate term. Now, this one is kind of near and dear to me. It, too, by the way, is in the monthly income portfolio. And this one is where every January we take money out of our investment accounts that are there for long-term growth. We take it out and we put aside our annual income in one lump sum the first week of each year. And we take our first month's distribution, and the other 11 months, that money is put into a short-term bond fund rather than a money market fund. And my wife and I know that we're taking a little bit of risk, but we're always looking at that relationship between risk and return. And because short-term bond funds don't have a lot of volatility, we're okay with that. And what we do know is, if we look at the last 10 years, is that that particular bond fund, the investor shares, has compounded, this is total return, any principal value plus the income, at 3.4% a year. Now, that's the good news. That's a much better return than we would have had in a money market fund. By the way, I've not been retired for 10 years, but I thought it would be good to look back 10 years because I want to face the music here. I want to face the, well, not such pretty music of what happened in 2008. But when we look at that 10-year period on the short-term bond fund, there was a year, 2008, that corporate bonds got tagged big time. In fact, high-yield bond funds in some cases were down 40% that year. Not the Vanguard. It was down about 20%, I believe. But the short-term investment-grade bond fund was actually down 4.2%. And that would be a big hit on somebody's the portfolio that is the source of their monthly income. Now, remember, I've talked so many times about how when you've oversaved, you don't have to be quite so sensitive to short-term declines. And my wife and I, we oversaved. So the fact that we would have to suffer a 4% return, a loss on that short-term bond fund certainly wouldn't be catastrophic, wouldn't change our lifestyle. Now, the good news, the following year, that fund went up 14.3%, right at 14%. A huge year. And that's because people realized, as so often happens, that they had responded with a lot of fear that wasn't necessary. But again, we never know. So a short-term bond fund is going to have much less volatility, but it still has lost some of the principal value, because if it had stayed even the whole year, we would expect to be up all of the interest or dividends that it was paid. So yes, it did too have a decline in its principal value, but the interest rate was enough to offset that. Now we go to another extreme, also part of the of that monthly income portfolio at Vanguard, which, by the way, you can simply go to paulmerriman.com and go to mutual funds and go to Vanguard, and you'll see that as one of the many Vanguard portfolios we have. And it's for people who are simply trying to take a relatively conservative approach to diversifying amongst many different kinds of bonds, but you're not looking for high stability, you're looking for better return in terms of the payout. High yield. Now, I already mentioned that high yield took a real whooping in 2008. It came roaring back with huge returns in 2009. But what about this year? Through November 5th, the high-yield bond fund at Vanguard has done a little better than break-even at 0.3%. That's a fund that the SEC yield is about 6%, a little over 6%. So it's down, the principal value is, but it pays out enough of an interest, a level of dividends and interest, to make up for that loss of principal. And the final of the four funds in that portfolio is a Ginnie Mae fund. Now, the Ginnie Mae fund 30-day yield is about 2.9%, and that fund is down 1.95%. It has a relatively a short maturity, I think around 4 or 5 years, as I recall. So look at all these different kinds of returns. Some people could say, oh, I'm doing fine. Well, you're doing fine to the extent that the interest that was paid out possibly was more than the value of the principal that went down. Or you could say, I've taken a real shellacking here in this intermediate term bond. I'm down 2.4% so far this year. And by the way, I think the worst, going back to 1970, the worst year with the intermediate term bond fund. Oh, by the way, that's a treasury, not a corporate. Was a loss of a little over 4%. So that is a discussion about this relationship of interest rates and maturities, and so as would be expected, the longer the maturity, the greater the pain, except for high yield, because high yield funds are kind of a cross between a hybrid between the stock and a bond. And so oftentimes during periods that the market's doing well and interest rates are going up, high yields can do okay because they're reflecting the increasing grades of the underlying bonds. In other words, in a good economy, high yield bonds and the companies that issue them, they tend to get better in terms of their financial health, and that might increase the quality of the bond, and that would sometimes help those bonds in what would otherwise be a bear market for bonds. But he goes on then to ask, now I hope he understands why there's a negative return, but he asked, if I invested in individual bonds and didn't care about selling them before maturity, would I not get a positive return the regular dividend represents? Well, look, no, you wouldn't get a positive return, but it would be seen as a positive return. I'll never forget what a lesson it was for me back in the 1966, 67, when I first got licensed. I was a stockbroker for just 2 or 3 years back in the 60s. But I had clients that for many years of their investing career, they had been purchasing individual bonds. And in particular, my memories are that it was the municipal bonds where this was a common challenge. And they would buy these municipal bonds and literally put them away in a safety deposit box. And they got their interest payments and everything was okay. Didn't matter what was going on in the bond market. They were getting their their semi-annual payments. Mutual funds pay monthly, but individual bonds do not. Anyway, so I sold them some loaded bond funds. And so they basically owned the same as what they had in terms of the quality of the bonds. But they've got diversification and so I could make the case, that's what they teach us to do, make the case for paying a load to get into a fund. By the way, those same people, when they bought individual bonds, were oftentimes paying a huge load or commission. They just didn't know it because of the way that bonds were priced. But that's another story. So here's what happened. I sold them these funds, and what could they do? Every day they could look up the price of those funds in the newspaper. And oh my God, sometimes those funds went down. What's going on here? I mean, they were furious because they had owned individual bonds forever. Those bonds never went down. Well, it turns out they actually did. If they tried to sell them, they would find out the value of those bonds went down. But they were not buying those bonds to sell them. They were not investing in those mutual funds to sell them. But the difference was this. When they could see, even if it went down a penny or two on the share price, that was upsetting because they were in bonds because they didn't want to lose any money. What's going on here? Well, when you don't have to see the value every day and you just take your interest and you, it does whatever it does, so you don't reinvest it. You don't reinvest it with an individual bond unless you go out and specifically want to do that. But with a bond fund, you can automatically reinvest that interest as it's paid out, which is a good discipline, and it's one of the marvelous efficiencies of the bond fund. So the bond price, if you're not going to ever sell it, you could say, I don't care. On the other hand, if you're in a mutual fund, which does not have a maturity date, or at least most of them do not, if you're in an individual mutual fund and interest rates go up, what happens is that new money comes into that fund. And as the new money flows into that fund, it is buying those bonds, new bonds, at higher interest rates, so that the dividend rate over time in the fund goes up, which cannot happen to the individual bond that you own in your portfolio. Now, there are lots of pros and cons about bond funds versus individual bonds. And for a lot of people, the idea of seeing the value go down, and by the way, they also go up, is something that people would not like to have as part of their bond portfolio. They don't mind giving up the upside. This is true with stocks. This is absolutely true with equities. You can look at the long-term return of equities. You can see they are twice, in some cases, three times what you would get in the bond market over time. But that short-term pain is more than they're willing to sustain. And that's one reason a lot of people need an advisor, even if it's only for the time to figure out who the heck you are, where you are going to fold, where you're going to give up, and what's that going to cost you if you do. I mean, those are huge decisions, understanding yourself. Okay, let's go on here to question number two. He says, I know you're a big advocate of small cap value, and I'm wondering what your findings are on mid cap 400 funds. Have you done an apples to apples comparison with small and mid cap value? And he goes on to suggest that the small cap value has underperformed mid-cap value. Well, there's a whole different levels of complexity in how I could answer or respond to this, because as I've written maybe a year ago about the difference in returns for small-cap value itself, there are many different ways it can be measured, and quite a bit of difference in the return of these different indexes. Doesn't mean that the index that's been the best in the last 20 years is the small cap value index that's going to be the best for the next 20 years. But there are differences. And so, first of all, let me go at this a couple different ways. Let me go back to that table where we compare the number one rated asset class over 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, and 40-year periods, comparing small-cap value, small-cap growth, large-cap value, large-cap growth, and many more. And no, we don't have the data to do that with mid-cap growth and value. At least I don't. I'm sure that somebody does, but I don't. So what do we know? We do know, if we look at large and small, that small cap over 20 years, small cap value over 20 years, has outperformed the rest 72.8% of the 20-year periods. By the time we get out to 40 years, it's about 94%. But at 20 years, 72.8%, with large cap value, 5.5% of the 20-year periods, it was number one. So that means that there's about a 1 in 20 chance that next 20 years, large cap value will do better than small cap value based on the past. So I have strong feelings about the difference, the likely outcome of large cap value versus small cap value, just as I do large cap growth and small cap growth. Historically, those have not been good performers compared to the value indexes. Now, let me take it another, let me drag out my old Live It Up Without Outliving Your Money, a book that I think we wrote in about 2005. There's a chapter in here that shows in deciles how different asset classes perform. It's fascinating. Go to the library, check it out, look at it. I think you'll find it of interest, even though it's not right up to date. But what we did here was, we didn't do it. Dimensional Funds did this this study, but they looked at different periods of time, and I'm looking at page 67, and in Live It Up Without Outliving Your Money. And what we see, the very, very largest companies, the 1/10 of the public companies that were the largest, and from 1965 to 1968, the very largest 10% of companies were up about, it looks like it's a bar graph here, up about 40%. If we then go to the next 10% of companies, up about 45%. If we go to the kind of the middle of the pack, the fifth decile, up about 150%. Three times, more than three times the very largest companies. By the time we get out to the bottom 10%, and by the way, that mid-cap would run around, let's just say, that middle of those deciles was up about 150. If you went to the 10th decile, the smallest companies, up 350%. So guess which kind of mutual fund would have likely done the best? Certainly not the S&P 500. That would be a dog compared to the more risky small cap. That was the micro cap, if you want to look at it in those terms. Now, that was from 65 to 68. Then from 69 to 74, and by the way, think of the sales pitch that a salesperson has selling small cap, if they were selling back then small cap funds. They weren't called that, but if they were, it'd be a great sales pitch. Why would you be sitting in those doggy old S&P 500 funds when you could have had some real action, made some real money? Come on, get on board. But then from 69 to 74, just as these deciles just stair-stepped right up, the smaller the companies got, in the next period, from 69 to 74, it steps pretty much right on down the smaller it got. In other words, let's just give you a couple numbers here. In the largest 10% of companies, the S&P, that would include the S&P 500. In fact, let me go to the second decile here, which would more reflect the S&P, was down about 20%. And then, as you go down, let's go to the fifth decile, down almost 50. Let's go to the 10th decile, the smallest ones, the ones that had been so great the previous period, down over 70%. So I'm just going to take you to one more. I know this, for those people who don't like for me to talk about a graph, I may not be explaining this as colorfully as you would like, but let me give you one more, and I think you'll get the feeling. If you go from 1975 to 1983, one of the greatest bull markets of all time. Remember the small cap that was down 70%? Well, guess what? For that period from 75 to 83, the very smallest 10% up 1400%. 1400%. While the S&P 500 was up 220% or something. Nothing. I mean, 1/7 or 1/6. Ah, let's look at the mid-cap. Right in the middle, the fifth decile, up 800%. Great place to be, but not as great as being in the smaller deciles. So, and it goes on and on. Now, by the way, I don't mean to imply it's an absolutely even stair-step process here, because as I look, let me look at the period from 1991 to 1993. The very small, up over 150% approximately. S&P 500 up less than 60%. But I notice that the fifth decile was up about 100%. The sixth decile did not go up. In fact, it was up probably about 115%. The seventh decile, getting smaller, up a little over 100%. The eighth decile, even smaller, up less than 100%. But then by the time you get to the 10th decile, it jumps way up to be number one. So I don't want to imply that every decile, every time, moved exactly stair-step and up and stair-step and down. But generally, so when I look at these, you would see the reason that a person would believe, both from looking at these studies of large versus small, but when you break them up into deciles over time, you would conclude that mid-cap is not going to make as much money as small-cap. Now, let's remember one other thing, and this isn't for all of you, but it is for some of you. If you said, I wonder what a good strategy would be on rebalancing. If I want to make the most amount of money, but I want to be well diversified, what is the implication of investing out at the edges, the very large and the very small? Well, you would see that during that period of time, going back to, for example, the period from 1969 to 1974, if during that period of time when you were losing tons of money in the small cap, you had been rebalancing from the larger, by the way, they were both losing money, both the very large and the very small, but the small was losing money at a much faster clip. So you were taking some of those better returns, even though they were negative returns, from the large cap and putting it into rebalance to the small cap. Well, then guess what? You get rewarded in the next range of years while small cap is taken off like a rocket and the large cap is struggling. And then for the period from 1984 to 1990, as a matter of fact, I mean, this is how bad it can be, how different it can be. And this is why you shouldn't be shocked when small cap underperforms large cap, or large cap underperforms small cap by a lot. From 1984 to 1990, the S&P 500 was up over 150%, while the smallest 10% of companies were down, it looks to me like about 30%. Think of that. I mean, how can that be? How can there be so much difference? Well, if you looked at these bar charts, you would say, whatever the power or the energy behind it, this is what over time is not abnormal, are these big swings at either end. And so I think if you're going to be a rebalancer, there are some advantages of being on the edges, catching the wave that's going to be the biggest going up, and being able to put it into that was going to turn around and probably be the hero for the next particular cycle. So, and by the way, that does not mean that for the people that are young people, I said you could put your money in small cap value from age 20 to age 30 or 35. If you really wanted to be aggressive, and you'd probably just do fine based on what we know about the past. But there is a certain feeling of success when you have, let's say you have your portfolio divided between small and large, or growth and value, and part of your portfolio is doing okay. That does give people oftentimes the ability, the willingness to stay the course and continue to hold what they're doing, or keeping the discipline of rebalancing between these really good asset classes for the long term. But sometimes it's important for people to have something in their portfolio that's making them feel good in order to have the patience to let the thing that's now struggling be there when it comes back and it's doing well. Question number three. What are your thoughts on the following two international stock funds, and then list them? Morningstar recommended both of them, the writer says. If you suggest other foreign funds as opposed to these two, could you please share your recommendations? Well, first of all, those two funds that you give me, that you suggested, are large cap. And that's not bad. They're both good funds for large cap blend, basically. On the other hand, if you were to check out at paulmerriman.com, our recommendations for mutual funds at Vanguard and Fidelity and others, you would see that there are recommendations there for other asset classes. And at Vanguard, there's large cap blend, large cap value, small cap blend, and emerging markets. On the other hand, if you looked in the best in class ETF recommendations, and you would go to the ETF link and then look in best in class, you would see there are recommendations internationally for large cap blend, large cap value, small cap blend, small cap value, and even emerging markets as well. So, yes, there are lots of recommendations. With your patience, and this goes to all of you who see mutual funds being recommended all over the place, certainly Morningstar, they're in the business of noting mutual funds. If they ever gave you a list of these are the only 10 funds we want you to own, that would be the end of a lot of their service. So they have to be writing about different mutual funds and recommending them as well. And by the way, there are lots of newsletters that recommend individual funds that will be different than what I recommend, because what we're recommending are basically index funds, not in all cases, but in most cases. So I hope that helps answer that particular question. Question number four. How should I consider the stable value funds in my investment allocation? I have considered them as being bonds since they are not stocks and offer security as one hopes bonds would. And by the way, the stable value funds are created, and lots of 401ks have these, are basically either one insurance company provides the underlying guarantee, or the 401k plan will own a security that represents many insurance company guarantees. But they basically guarantee to maintain, like a money market fund, the $1 value of that portfolio. And it isn't based, by the way, on the performance of the underlying portfolio. It is based on the guarantee of the insurance company. And I think you folks that are not aware of stable value funds would find them, it's worth the time to read Investopedia on stable value funds. But they do maintain that $1 value, like a money market fund. But they pay out a lot more. Remember, this is a guarantee from the insurance company, and the insurance companies are going to invest that money. They will be taking more risk than what would be suggested by that $1 guarantee, but they are willing to do that because they are investing for the long term, and it does perform a function because they do, at some risk, and the risk is the guarantee of the insurance company, but they are creating an instrument that is able to pay out more. So you may find a stable value fund that during the period of time that interest rates at money market funds were, you know, 0.1% or less, those stable value funds within a 401k may have been paying 2 or 3%. Now, there'll be periods. There will be periods when the money market funds will pay as much or even more, but intermediate-term bond funds will pay appreciably more than the stable value funds. So I think that in a portfolio when we look at a portfolio, a 401k plan that could, let's say they had a short-term bond fund and they had a stable value fund, I would pick that stable value fund as it is not going to have any volatility and likely actually a equal or better return than that a short-term bond fund. Now, having said that, sometimes the short-term bond fund would do better. But we also can look at, and those of you, again, who follow our recommendations on our portfolios at Vanguard and Fidelity and elsewhere, that we don't just recommend short-term bond funds, just as we wouldn't just recommend a stable value fund, because there are good premiums for including intermediate-term bond funds. So we actually have, in many cases, more money in intermediate-term government bond funds than we would have in short-term. Now, what do I know about the past? I cannot tell you what the return of the last, last 48 years of the stable value funds, what return has been. I'm going to guess it's probably around 5% from my experience and my memory. I do know that an investment in an intermediate-term bond fund over the last 48 years, that's had a 7% compound rate of return. So I would expect, with more volatility, a better return in the intermediate-term bond than I would the stable value, but I would expect a better return from the stable value than I would a short-term bond fund, and certainly than a money market fund. But his question gets a little more interesting here. He says, look, if I go to the stable value funds, or even cash, he says, and I wouldn't want to recommend that, could I increase the percentage I own in stock index funds? He's considering changing the way that he allocates between bonds and stocks if he puts all of his bond money in something that is even more stable, more conservative. Because remember, the reason for the bonds in that portfolio, in terms of like a 401k or a long-term portfolio, my own portfolio, I'm not looking for the interest rates they're paying out. I'm looking for the stability to offset the volatility of the equities. And yes, you could, in fact, afford to pick up maybe another 5 or 10% in the stock part of your portfolio if you had all of your fixed income in a stable value fund. Number five. Boy, this is an interesting one. And nobody's ever asked me this question before. This particular email has a whole bunch of questions that I think will be answered in a video / podcast that Chris Pedersen and I did the same day we did the video podcast on Two Funds for Life. But here's the interesting question for me, because it's a huge dilemma. Question is, how can a do-it-yourself investor like me keep up with your new recommendations if you stop updating the portfolios? Well, I'm going to rephrase that. I guess it's a question of, what would you do if our website, our recommendations didn't exist? And so I have several answers to that, because this is a dilemma. I'm 75 years old. I have great hope that two things. One, that we will have somebody with the same commitment to doing this for the long term that I do. We've had the good fortune of having Chris Pedersen working with us for 2 years. I just find him to be not only an amazingly bright fellow, but also just one of the nicest people to work with. And boy, have I been lucky in my career to have some nice people to work with, and Chris is one of them. And I think he might have a willingness to carry on if I had to stop. I have a grandmother that ended her life with Alzheimer's, or it was called dementia. I have a mother who ended her life with Alzheimer's, an uncle who ended his life with Alzheimer's. It's been my biggest concern is the stability of my brain. So who knows what that future is. But not only do I have to find somebody like Chris, and maybe Chris, maybe my son. Certainly I have hopes that he might pick up the mantle and be willing to take this on when I no longer can do it. But I am trying to create a financial base to be able to support actually paying somebody to do what I'm willing to do for nothing. But you still have to find somebody who's got this commitment to helping people the way that we are on our website. So that's one. We're going to try to do this with people. We're going to try to do this with money. But my belief is that we can create the knowledge base, and we're working on it, that you would be able to do this without us. I'm not going to tell you the one of the projects I'm working on right now, because I tend to overpromise, and sometimes things take a year longer than I expect. Sometimes they never happen. But I do want to do all I can in the next year to make people as independent of a baseline, a foundation of education that would allow you to make good decisions without Chris or myself having to pick out those funds for you. You should have information from us. You don't have it yet, not exactly. That whatever 401k plan you have, you should be able to sort through a decision tree that would help you know exactly what we would recommend. And so that's a project that's on our table. But we are certainly aware that there are just a handful of us doing this. Now, there are other people out there, the Bogleheads, And that's a very fine organization. And lots of people come to the Boglehead site and share what they believe. The problem there, I think, is you're having to pick and choose from hundreds or thousands of people who are all, I think, smart people who really are into understanding this process. But my belief is that somehow we need to take it from having 1,000 possible answers to having it be a small handful that would be very obvious what it is that you should be doing. And I might add to that the people right now who are following our work, I think if they didn't find us, they would have found somebody else that would help them. Because the internet, a lot of folks out there that understand the investing process. I think what might make us different is our willingness to name names of funds to be in or ETFs to be in. But I do think that the problem is not for the folks that are following us now. Our problem is how do we help the people who would like to be involved in making a decision once, maybe twice in their lifetime. And of course, I can see this is possible with target date funds, and I can see this is possible with two funds or maybe three funds, that we could get enough information out there that people who really don't want to go out and search the internet could find a base of knowledge that would give them the confidence to do the right thing. And I also believe this is really great news, that universities, colleges, universities, they are going to figure out a way to teach this. I go to a meeting next week at Western, where I'm going to be discussing with them a strategy that, by the way, I think they already are committed to, but a strategy that educates all Western students a little bit each year for 4 years. And when I say a little bit, I don't mean a tiny little bit, but will give them enough that when they come out of that institution, that they will absolutely know what they should be doing with their 401k, with their IRA, and they will understand the cost of a charge card, and they will understand about the decision of spending versus saving, and they will understand that saving is really all about spending. That when you save, all you're doing is you are delaying the spending of that money till later. But it is still about spending. But it is money to be spent when you're not getting money from the people who pay you to work. And it sounds like such a simple concept, but it is something that I think takes some education. Anyway, my point is this, is that there is going to be a way, I think, to get everybody up and in, not everybody, but a lot of people, more than we're contacting today, up and independent in their ability to analyze what they should be doing with their money. And one last question for today, number 6. Basically, the question is, do I prefer mutual funds or ETFs? Because we recommend both. For my own portfolio, my buy and hold portfolio, which is what I'm advocating 99.9% of investors do, my wife and I own mutual funds. There are things about mutual funds versus ETFs that I prefer. I prefer the fact that when I decide to sell, that I know what price I'm going to get. Yes, it's the last price of the day, in essence. But there will be no split between a bid and ask. It will be priced on the last trade of the day. Could be a good trade, could be a bad trade, but it's that trade. And when you've got 15,000 stocks in your portfolio, as the most well-diversified index investors likely have, particularly my age, then you're not going to have to pay the spread between the bid and ask. And you're not going to have to pay somebody a commission to make that trade. I really like that because it not only am I investing in completely mechanical strategies, index funds, but I'm also using a strategy that makes the way it's priced mechanical for everybody. And with ETFs, we don't know what price you're going to get. I don't mean to suggest for a second that you're going to get an illegal price, but there is a spread between the bid and ask. And you can see that. When you go to look at Morningstar, there can be, after hours, by the way, you'll see a spread, a bid and ask price, which will be very large. Now, that is not the spread that's going to be there when the market is open. But during the day, when the market is open, there will be times when that spread will get larger. And sometimes you can even potentially buy at a discount. I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen, but it's moving around. And I just like mutual funds because they're not moving around when I want to sell. They're not moving around when I want to buy. But it takes more money. ETFs, yeah, you can, with ETFs, with $100, you can give somebody $1 million portfolio. So that's my preference, mutual funds, index funds, very low-cost index funds that do give you a better, if because you put more money in, you get a better price, I think that's okay because you're going to be there one day if you're not there now. On the other hand, with ETFs, you get a great deal at Vanguard, for example, or at Schwab, or at Fidelity. You get a great deal for a relatively small investor. So they both work. And of course, this is part of this process of the way humans are. I grew up with mutual funds. They've been my friend. I know them. I know them more intimately, I feel, than I do the ETF. I'm sure with young people, they probably are going to feel the same way about the ETF. I think I'll respond to a question as I close here today that I've had many times over the last few years. The question is, do we accept donations? We have, in fact, had a few donations, but they have been from people who have wanted to hire me to speak, because I don't personally take any income, they have made donations to our foundation. But it is my intent in the before the end of the year to make it possible for people who would like to donate to our cause. But I want to wait until I can make it very specific of what the use of any money that was contributed to this organization, where it would go and what it would accomplish. I would be interested in what your ideas would be, that if you were going to donate, and I'm not going to keep a list of your names to solicit, but I promise, but if in fact you were donating, what it is you would like this foundation to do, what it would to do about young people, about retired people. That's just an open-ended question. Drop me an email, paul@paulmerriman.com, and tell me what more that we might be able to do, and what we could do better than we're doing right now. So I look forward to hearing from you. Yes, there will be a way for people who would like to help financially. I certainly have that commitment with our own funds, and happy to have people join us. Thank you for listening, and good luck to all of you.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.